for him, you know, to say, yeah, I couldn't say it was not expensive, because it was. But I, it provided an unambiguous identification, right, which GC didn't do. But nevertheless, he was the boss, you know, and what he said goes. And so the job I saw was, we had to find some way to prove that it was really worth the money, mm-hmm, that it was costing. And nobody ever talked about cost per analysis. And, you know, and it's easy to look back with 20/20 hindsight and say, that was obvious, but it wasn't obvious at all. And that, you know, people talked about the cost of the equipment. And so, and we were well, and we went out and started visiting customers, and this was with Dave Hoyt, mm-hmm, who was working for me as a summer intern from Stanford Business School. And I had Dave, and we were visiting various customers, both EPA and contract labs and, right, Shells and Monsanto and so on, industrial users, and asking them, you know, why do you use GC&S to do your analysis? And they would say, well, it's the cheapest way to do it. And I would say, well, God, it costs you a bundle for it. How can it be the cheapest? And they would just say, you know, I don't know, but it's cheaper, and we get the right answer, and we believe we can defend the answer that we get. And furthermore, EPA, the labs, you know, they look over our shoulder, also have the, mm-hmm, same instrument. But we went out, and it was a long time before we started, really got the concept that we should be looking at cost per sample, not total cost.
Right.
And so our study dealt with that, and we took and presented, we visited about 60 people and maybe 35 or 40 labs, and wound up with numbers. We did in-depth surveys a la SRI, mm-hmm, getting a handle on cost and you know, what ultimately, what is the cost per sample for you using, most of the labs use both GC and GC&S, so they had data that they could provide us. And we wound up putting all our numbers together and writing a paper that was a presentation initially, and I went around giving it to like the various parts of EPA, including Cincinnati and, mm-hmm, Athens and enforcement people at EPA, mm-hmm, Office of Permits, even in Doug Kossel's office, who was the administrator at that time, and went in on a Saturday, and we'd have a large number of people from EPA who were critiquing this before we ever published it. Hmm. And they were providing, you know, some pretty interesting inputs and questions. But the bottom line was that the data held up in court, right, and we, in Environmental Science and Technology, published it in as a feature article in I think 79. And the data was more or less accepted. I think EPA, first of all, Ballinger, it gave him the ammunition, especially when it was a peer-reviewed article, mm-hmm, gave him the ammunition to say, well, this is the cheapest way to do it, and we could point to 100 service labs who could do it for you for like $400 a sample.
At that, right, time.
And so he could promulgate a method that required GC&S and not lose his job, which certainly he was right in worrying about. And we really, EPA wound up deciding they should do their own study and not accept our numbers. And so they had a guy named Ed Branch, who they asked, he's an economist for EPA in EPA headquarters. They asked him to conduct, with some of his colleagues, a parallel study to find out for themselves.
Right.
And he had been a prime person we interviewed and worked with in coming up with our numbers. And so he really let's say he did his own study, but he came up with the same results, right, more or less. And that's when the Office of Management and Budget signed off on it, and it became an official.
And that was in the later part of 79?
In 79, it was formally proposed.
Right.
And it didn't, I think it was finally, finally became the law in 84 sometime. It was quite a long time.
Right.
Change in administration, and
right,
Reagan came in, and you know, he killed, practically killed off EPA. But nevertheless, industry and environmental folks almost worldwide accepted it upon what EPA actually proposed it as the method. And they proposed GC along with GCMS. But there are a lot of, if you were to call any EPA office, they would tell you, we're using GCMS, you use whatever you want, you know, either method is
right,
acceptable, but the most important thing was, what were you using, you know? And they were unequivocal in saying, well, and I might add that we did one thing very fortuitous in our study, and that is we published reliability of data,
mm-hmm,
which meant how accurate is this,
yeah,
data. And the lawyers at EPA really caught on. The first time I presented to them, you know, they didn't care about, you know, a lot of the costs on it, sort of things. They were really interested in the reliability, which we had gathered as we went along, and we had a lot of backup for that, massive backup. And it showed GC to be a fairly unreliable technique for a majority of the product groups.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, and so I kept trying to find out from them, why are you so interested in that part of it? And they said, well, it costs us $1,000 or $1,500 to collect the sample. It costs us, let's say, $400 or maybe $500 to run it. It costs us to defend the work. It costs us thousands of dollars, and $10,000 is not an unusual number. You know, just to defend,
yeah,
data in court. And if a user or a petrochemical company presented data and EPA didn't have GCMS or vice versa, one of those parties is going to wind up,
yeah,
spending a lot of money trying to defend poor data, and that became the killer part of it in terms of really requiring GCMS rather than just recommending GCMS.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wanted to go to court with data that was indefensible.
Yeah.
And so it became the way to do it.
Was that the, like, a step function in the orders in after EPA, you know, has the mandated method, or was there a pretty?
I would say so.
Yeah.
Yeah. It became a really good sized business, and it through the 80s represented probably anywhere from 60 to 75% of our business at Finnegan, which was a lot. And
right,
we were dominating the market a good part of that time. And then the HP came in and really started sharing that,
mm-hmm,
with us, and it became a significant part of their business too.
To backtrack just a teeny bit, Systems Industries is supplying the data system component of the overall system through 73. So was that in fulfilling maybe that first 20, the order of 20 from the EPA, they still had the, that was with the System,
right,
Industries machine?
Yeah, and I'd say we probably delivered 400 systems or something with System 150.
Okay.
A large number.
And was, so it's right around, I mean, here are some events I see coming together in time. You get that initial order from the EPA labs for 20. You take the company public in, is it
72.
72.
Right.
So just a little bit after.
Right.
And then Quantum Matrix, Quantum Metrics, sorry, happens in 73.
Right.
So I guess what I'm asking is, was the decision to take Finnegan public in 72 tied up with the order that you got from the EPA and what you saw as the implications of that, as A, and then B, did that give you the capital that you needed to do an acquisition like for the?
Yeah, I would say we needed the money in order to be able to continue to build, you know, more and more instruments.
Right.
And I think we needed to have a public stock in order to acquire somebody, although we paid cash, as I recall, for Quantum Metrics. But we did raise money in order to, you know, have more flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't raise all that much. It was a very, very tough time to raise money. And we didn't get a very good price for our stock. I think it was pretty rock bottom. And we had another public offering in 74 because we needed more money then.
Mm-hmm.
And this again was to buy parts to make instruments and to expand our marketing sales force.
Right.
And, you know, do the things to sort of take advantage of the position that we were in. That if we didn't move fast, I mean, we always had HP. It's sort of like a giant steamroller right behind you, you know, and it just flattened you if you ever stopped running. They'd flatten you. I mean, they were not as, I would say, entrepreneurial as we were, but they were, you know, they were pretty quick to pick up on, you know, here's, you know, a market opportunity that we ought to be also in,
mm-hmm.
in sharing the market and getting a good part of it, and in fact, one in which HP felt that they ought to dominate at some point.
Mm-hmm. What changes did it bring? A lot of changes to how the company was operating, and did it bring a lot of changes going public?
Oh yeah, you are living in a fishbowl, so to speak, and you have analysts, H&Q, we were, I think, the second company they took public, and Spectrophysics being the first, and so they were very aware that they had to follow us and help us,
mm-hmm.
You know, make sure that we did well for their reputation,
okay.
as well as ours, and they had analysts visiting us quite often, and sort of, you know, keeping close track, doing write-ups, analyst write-ups for the public, for the customers out there. And I would say it required us to report a lot more rigorously than before what, you know, what we're doing, and to basically give our shareholders, you know, information on the company and why they should invest in us and continue to hold our stock.
Right.
So it changed our way of life a lot.
Did you encounter any problems with that financial community or the analysts, you know, stock analyst community? Oftentimes, when I'm talking to people, various people, you know, they decry sort of near-termism amongst analysts as really being inimical to the timelines that you need for some really forward-looking development project. Did you?
Well, I think initially, you know, we were growing pretty fast, and nobody was they were happy to see that. And so it's only when things turn down that they become, you know, nervous. But I'd say they were watching us pretty closely the whole way, and we had to prove ourselves, you know, and be able to present in annual reports or whatever,
right,
present a story that, you know, they really hung together. And I think Hammer and Quist was a lot of help, and at that time they were oriented towards small companies.
Mm-hmm.
We had spent a lot of time with George Quist and Bill Hembrick, Roger Santisi and I,
mm-hmm,
and they really thought long and hard, and maybe a whole year before agreeing to take us public. And it was a very difficult offering,
right,
because we were not all that established and not doing all, didn't have all that great a track record. But it was essential that we do that in order to really to grow at a rate where we could keep our market share.
Mm-hmm.
And HP had internal money, and they didn't have that problem we had. And so we really had, all our competitors were big companies like HP and Varian and,
right,
AEI, I'd say all of them were a lot larger, PerkinElmer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really, in trying to combat, let's say we're taking market away in some cases, or creating new markets, but they're all, you know, ready to join in with you. and some of them like HP in a very solid way.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick question about, or do you want to pause for a second?
No.
Okay, we'll just keep going. A quick question about, you know, we talked just then about the changes of going public. I wanted to ask you if you had some words to say about the sort of organization that you built at Finnegan in terms of, with your colleagues, in terms of the culture, thoughts about R&D and the relationship between R&D and production, which is oftentimes a big problematic interface, and those sorts of characteristics, I guess.
Well, I think that's a series of questions.
Yeah.
and we were research oriented from the beginning, and obviously at the very beginning spending more on research than we were on anything else. As we went through this phase, like getting EPA, mm-hmm, orders and industry orders following that, we continued to invest heavily in R&D, and Mike Story was the person in charge of that during most of that period. And we probably were investing 15% to 20% in many of those years, mm-hmm, in R&D, which is pretty excessive,
pretty high,
but was needed.
Mm-hmm.
And we were working on new products like the Ion Trap.
Right.
We probably spent 3 or 4 years with the fellow who's in charge of research right now, George Stafford, working on that when there didn't seem to be anything coming out the end of the funnel. So we were research oriented, and we were also developing markets where we were, you know, we were bootstrapping the markets.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, there was no market before we came in, and they didn't know that they needed GCMS. You had to show them what it could do. And environmental was certainly an example, but markets in drug testing and,
right,
in law enforcement and so on,
mm-hmm, were,
all of those required a lot of spade work. And,
mm-hmm,
and I would say we were fortunate in many ways, in having someone like Mike Story who got along well with everybody, and was, while he was heading R&D, he had also had worked in manufacturing and was able to work with the people, so there was not a lot of jealousies or competition.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, I think, fortunate in having TZ who had come from Airgraph, where he had been a general manager.
Right.
And really, my reason for wanting him was that I, first of all, didn't have experience in setting up the systems and procedures and the, all of the, you know, the follow-all, I would call it, you know, in running day-to-day,
yeah,
running a company and, you know, making all the minute decisions that have to be made,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, and looked into before you make decisions, and working, getting a, you know, a bunch of disparate parts of the company working together, yeah, and keep them working together. And I felt that that wasn't my bag. I didn't really want to do it,
mm-hmm,
and had probably, you know, gone out of my way to avoid it several times in my career. But it allowed me to really to go out there and find the markets for the products we have and help define most often with Mike Story the products for the markets,
okay,
and with customers. I would say we were always very close, and we didn't have a lot of formality in the company, and we had a lot of trust. And I would say that where nobody would second guess anyone else, and when I'm, you know, helping to find like an environmental market or others, people, and define the product, what the product has to, mm-hmm, be for that market. I was not, I had no great pride of ownership, and if I said, you know, this is what I think, anybody could say, I disagree like hell with you, mm-hmm, you know, and we wouldn't, I would not take offense to that. And I would want to know, well, you know, what's your better idea? And,
right.
You know, let's work, figure out. And there was such a dialogue going all the time amongst the key members that it was, we didn't have, especially in the early days, didn't have problems. And we relied on TZ to make it happen, mm-hmm, and, you know, get manufacturing cranked up to produce what we needed. And to, when we were, like during our study, defining a new product, the organics and water analyzer, mm-hmm, to turn the Queen Mary, you know, a few degrees to, you know, come up with the product that's needed. And he and I were very close, and we would talk almost every day or two on the phone when I was in the field a good bit of
right.
time. Defining what's needed, you know, talking about problems that we had, and ultimately making sure we're both on the same frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And we were partners, and Roger was the third partner. And Roger took off in 1974 to become the Deputy Secretary of Energy, mm-hmm, in the Ford administration. And that was a loss. He was chairman of the board, and he was the third member, the third partner in the company, and
mm-hmm,
and I really missed him a lot. And that he had to leave the board while he was in Washington.
Right.
And then he came back on the board after he left the department. It was called the Department of Energy at that time,
mm-hmm,
or it had a different name from what it is now. That DOE, it had a different name.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was always a hell of an idea man. He was the most innovative person I've ever run across in my whole life.
Hmm.
In being able to come up with all of that ideas and help to find better ways and different ways, you know, when you're in a, especially when you're in a box. And
right.
And so Roger was sorely missed, especially by me, and we were the original two founding partners, mm-hmm, I have to say. And so we had to find ways to get around that loss, but I stayed in touch with him and I visited him when he was working in Washington for Energy Department,
mm-hmm,
and he would come up with names of people that I could visit to, like people from EPA, that one of them became my lobbyist in Washington. And he always had ideas that were just good ideas. And, you know, and so it's a great guy to have on your side. But we didn't, we weren't real formal in our setup. And especially in the, you know, through about 1980.
It was, right.
We were really, we had a lot of outstanding people, and it was sort of keeping them all working in the same direction.
Right, and I wanted to, obviously, all of those travels, and, you know, getting, steering the company through those difficult times and thinking about new technologies and having a large family, you know, kept you, you know, off the streets. But I was just wondering if you had any time to develop, you know, personal hobbies and interests over this time. Did you keep up with golf? Or
I didn't have time for golf. But I played handball 3 days a week through thick and thin.
Right.
When I was in town. And I was I played reasonably good handball as I'd say A or B player, depending on who I was playing. But I played, and even through the busiest and worst times, I would take off during the day at noontime. Instead of having lunch, I'd go over and play handball. And so I converted over to squash, which became my, I think when I was 59, my fingers were so gnarled that I had to do something different, and I started playing squash. But and so I had, you know, that was one hobby. Wine was another hobby. You keep learning and learning about wines and collecting wines and. Skiing, I skied with my wife and I together. We'd go skiing, starting around 69, I think, and for maybe till we were skiing until I got sick,
right?
Here, so, or snowshoeing or whatever. And so, yeah, had hobbies and really. Tennis was another sport I really enjoyed. With the family, obviously, had many demands.
Yeah.
And I don't think I did as well in that regard. Being gone, and my wife, a lot of it fell on her shoulders, and that wasn't a good thing. But you don't have any choice is the problem, you know, the bottom line. And she really was a partner through the whole thing, and it couldn't have happened without, you know, her being willing to shoulder a lot of what it should have been my job. We lived in this house through the whole, we bought this house while I was at EAI and lived in it ever since.
Oh, wow.
And so we had a good base of operations.
A stable base of operations.
I was, somewhere on there you asked a question. I did have extracurricular activities as well. I worked for the American Electronics Association. I was on their board of directors for 3 or 4 years and started their environmental occupational health.
Oh.
I co-founded it with the CEO of HP, and there were three of us that were founders of that. It was Dean Morton was his name. He was the chief operating officer and co-CEO at Hewlett-Packard. And he and I were the two, he was the first chairman of it, and then I took over. And for a period of, I'd say 7 or 8 years, I was very involved in that and working as the director of AEA, which represented 4,000 electronics computer instrument companies. And guiding, basically helping foreign policy. And we wrote a large part of RCRA, the underground storage tank, the whole, that whole set of regulations that govern, you know, the regulation, the storage of various chemicals that are used in, you know, the semiconductor industry and gasoline stations, etc. We wrote at ADA, the group, and I, you know, the group working with me and with Dean Horton, wrote the regulations that were first adopted by the counties here in the Bay Area, and then by the state of California, and almost without change by EPA as part of RCRA.
Now, what years?
That was in the early 80s.
In the early 80s?
Yeah, 80. I was involved from 80 through 87 with AEA.